Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, I wanted to talk about how I think that we are getting really close to one of the big moments of change. And I've talked in this series about what has been happening, why things have gone wrong, how things work. And I've alluded to how I think things are going to come up against one of those sort of big shift moments. 2008 was obviously a major one, but you've got a bunch of others, the 2000 crisis, the 1998 Asian financial crisis. A lot of these things come along. Another significant one, of course, would be the 2020 big surge that resulted in that massive inflation wave, and we're still dealing with the consequences of it now. So I've alluded to all of these elements, but they're very difficult to predict, but I think I've got something here which can describe why things are potentially about to get very interesting. And I'll explain how I see that all playing out. And you guys, you know my story on this. I mentioned it before. So just before the pandemic, I had sort of effectively retired. Well, it was semi-retirement. I was still doing a bit of consultancy stuff every now and again. And I've talked about how 2020 was very sort of life-changing for me, because I could see that a lot of the COVID stuff simply didn't make sense. I mean, initially, obviously, it was a concern, but then you got the Princess Cruise data and various other things and weird footage coming out of Italy and China, and this fear narrative being pushed really strong. And it was like, okay, something is odd here. And the other thing that really stuck out for me was how early in that narrative cycle that the money printing got turned on. And as we know, it was a vast, vast amount of money printing that got pushed out very early on. And it was like, okay, why is this happening? And that money printing continued to continue for quite a while. And the effects of that, you know, we've talked about in a number of episodes. But essentially, my bullshit detectors were on full alert. And I knew that there was a narrative being pushed here. So I saw this massive injection of liquidity, money printing effectively, was being limbered up. And I thought to myself at the time, okay, well, how do I ride this? How do I take advantage of this? Because, you know, I wasn't a fan of anything that was happening, but it was happening. So you kind of have to deal with that. So what I did is I looked for things that respond very well to liquidity. And the top ones are going to be, for the reasons I talked about, but we recap some of them here, is basically tech, long duration tech, because it's the thing with tech is you've got a series of earnings pushed out into the future, and they're discounted by the risk-free rate. And I could see that was about to get a massive liquidity injection, and therefore these things would be move up with it. And the other one that responds really well to liquidity was Bitcoin. So I leaned into that quite, well, very strong, actually. In retrospect, not enough. I should have sold the house and lent into it with that as well. But nevertheless, I did as much as I could without major disruptions to my lifestyle. I leaned in as hard as I could, and the results were excellent. Now, I tried to get as many friends and family on board with this as well. I wasn't successful in that element of it, I must say, because I was ringing people up and I was saying, these are the best market conditions that I've ever seen. But on their TV, they were seeing the world is ending. So I remember ringing one guy and telling him, look, mate, these are the best market conditions I've ever seen. Risk assets are about to shoot up. And they did. But the news was obviously going the other way. And I heard him at one point recap to his partner and say he thinks we should be investing now. And his partner said he must be mad. The world's going to hell. But the narrative in the news and what financial markets are doing are very different things. And big money flows do significantly affect things. In fact, for most of my career, I was, as you know, a venture capitalist. And that involves a lot of, you know, kicking the tires. You go out to companies, you spend days getting to know the staff, getting to know the business and the process. You then spend weeks looking at the financials. You do a lot of work on understanding a company that you think can have good movement. But because we were now in the era of these massive liquidity injections coming in and out of the economy, coming in and out of markets, I started to realise, well, you know, why spend all of that time and all of that brain power on individual companies, when actually the more powerful thing to do is just to understand the liquidity flowing around the economy, which is just going to dwarf all of those micro effects, those individual companies, you know, getting the advantage on that one, which is a bit of a shame that markets now operate like that, but they do. It is now more dependent on what a couple of people at policy level decide to throw into something. So anyway, let's get deep on that. Where do these massive tidal forces of liquidity come from? What's driving this liquidity? And by liquidity, I mean, if, to oversimplify, you know, money printing, money injection, it's not really that, but, you know, for the sake of it, it is extra money sloshing around. And I thought, okay, how do I explain this? And what's the 30,000 foot view as to how all this came to happen? That's what I want to talk about in this video. And I've talked about it a whole bunch, obviously, on Brokenomics, but it's so significant. And my spidey senses are telling me that, well, a bit more than that. I've got a fair bit of data to back all this up. But I feel that we're getting very close to another point of that liquidity spiking up quite sharply. And it kind of behooves me to be as clear as I can what I mean by all of this and what's going to happen and why, and what it's going to do to your money, what it's going to do to your assets, your mortgage, all of that. Now, you might say, okay, as some viewers will, well, I don't have any assets. You know, I don't have a mortgage or whatever it is. But you are exposed to the money system. Even if you're just earning a salary, you think about what the purchasing power effect of your salary has been between 2019 and now. Obviously, you've seen a significant reduction. So no matter what your stake in the economy is, I think the events of the next few years are going to have a significant effect on that. So it's worth understanding why all that is. And I think the key thing for people is to understand that money is not some fixed unit. You don't want to think of it as a fixed unit, as a neutral measuring yardstick. Money has value as well that can move up and can move down. Now, normally it goes down, the purchasing power of money goes down, it loses value, it's debased, it's diluted. It can sometimes go up, there are circumstances of that you see that more commonly between countries, between the purchasing power of different countries moving around. We even did a Brokenomics on Rome not so long ago with Bo, where we talked about one of the major financial crises that they had was there wasn't enough money available at a time that they needed some. There was no elasticity in the money supply, and it caused a major crisis, and the value of money, you know, went up significantly. So if you think about money as a medium that has a value that can move around, you're much closer to understanding what's going on. So what's causing this? What's the underlying issue? Now, you can go back a long way on this, but for me, the suitable starting point for this has to be the boomers, and not in a bad way, okay? I'm not bashing boomers. What I am saying is that they inherited a set of nascent transfer programs. These being, you know, things like pensions and medical care for elders and stuff like that. Now, of course, you know, the good people, they idolized their parents, particularly their parents, the ones who fought in the Second World War. And when the boomers were really coming into their height of their power in the 80s and 90s, during that period, it's not like it is now. Old people were poor, basically. So if governments wanted to do something for poor people, the easiest way by far to achieve that was to basically give money to old people, because they were almost synonymous between the two. Being old was to be poor, with exceptions, obviously. And they had these transfer programs, and what started to happen is they started to booster them and gold plate them. So things like pensions and medical care and all of those things were built up. And these were, of course, much loved programs. I think it was primarily well-intentioned, all of that, you know, doing it for older and poorer people, which is quite reasonable. There may have been an element of future-proofing because, of course, everybody gets old, and therefore, if you gold-plate these things, then you're going to start to benefit from it as well. But we were in a fundamentally different situation back then. The GI generation, the Greatest Generation, whatever you call them, and the Silent Generations, these were quite small generations. And the boomers came along, and obviously, as is implied in the name, the baby boom, there was a lot of them. So you had a lot of people being generous to a small number of people. And again, we talked about that before in previous Brokenomics. It wasn't just that. Women were increasingly coming into the workforce. So you've got a whole new gender, you know, coming into the workforce that wasn't there before. You had things like China with the trade agreements. You had India. So you had this massive injection of capita into the economy. And when these decisions were made on these transfer programs, the proportion of people in work was high and rising, which meant you had a large number of people who were fairly wealthy being generous to a small number of people who were, you know, significantly less wealthy. But these days, despite what some would say, there isn't a third gender waiting to come into the workforce, and there isn't a new continent ready to come into the workforce and contribute to all of this. And, you know, boomers were a large generation, and millennials and zoomers are not. I mean, actually, there is very slightly more millennials than there are boomers. But with all of these things, it's about the proportion. And zoomers are a smaller generation. So what's been happening is that, you know, for decades now, since the 80s, the trend rate of GDP has been falling and not rising. I think the trend rate of GDP now in, you know, Western economies is sub 2%. It's, you know, 1.5 to 2%, something around that level. What's happening is that workers are aging. The trend in the working age population has been down consistently since the 80s. And that has a number of effects. So the older you get, the less inclined you are to borrow because you're borrowing tapped out, or you are less willing to take on debt, or you have simply no need to because, you know, you've already got a home, you've already got a car, and those are the big things for borrowing. You've already invested in a business. You're less likely to be wanting to set up a new business at that age. And actually, also, I remember when I was younger, it was just not a thing that 60-year-olds got mortgages. I mean, they might have a tail end one, but they wouldn't be taking out new one. And I remember early in my sort of financial life seeing that there was a big push to say, no, actually, if you're in your 60s or even 70s, you can take out a new mortgage over the next 25 years. You know, whereas that simply wasn't a thing before. There was that attempt to get that debt expansion going on with a large population that was simply not getting into debt anymore. So the other thing that you could do is you can look at the birth rates. Right, and this is going to be highly predictable, of course, because with the birth rates, what you're actually interested in is you're interested in the proportion of working age people. Right, and you've already got the birth rate, so you just shift them forward 18 years, and that gives you the proportion of working age people that you can work out, you know, pretty consistently. So you can track that fairly accurately going forward, right? And in the early 80s, 90s, the proportion of people in work was in the high 60s. So, you know, high 60s%. So let's say 60, 68% or whatever of people were in work. And then it was the low 60s by the 90s. And then it's continuing to go on down. It's now in the very low 60s% of people in work, and it will very soon be in the 50% of people in the working age population. So you can see from that why Western economies are going bananas for immigration, because of course if you've got people exiting your workforce, they're taking the they are trending the rate of GDP down lower with them as they exit. But what you're doing is you're taking out Western boomers who are retiring, and these are people who are, of course, very inculcated in the culture. They understand how we work in the West. They understand how to get stuff done because, of course, they're immersed in this. And you're replacing them with, I don't know, Africans or wherever it is that people are coming in from. And necessarily those people are different. They're less immersed in the culture. They are less able to contribute in the way that, you know, somebody who has been immersed in this culture their whole life has. So they're desperately trying to make up for it with ever increasing amount of immigration, because otherwise these transfer programs that have set up, which are dependent on large working age populations, are simply not going to be able to sustain that. And that's why you've got these, you know, immigration levels trying to prop up these transfer programs that are in turn channeling money to the elderly, which are getting more costly because you're getting more and more elderly than you certainly had when these programs were set up and gold-plated in the way they were. And if you think about this, GDP is essentially, it's productivity growth, it's population growth, and the rounding error on that is going to be debt growth. That you go to debt if you can't get around that. So you know that debt has been rising strongly. But what's interesting is when you start to drill down into that, it's not personal debt that's been going up. That largely stopped, well, certainly by 2008, but definitely by 2008, personal borrowing just went flat. Corporate debt, that also went more or less flat. In fact, corporations have been, wherever possible, paying back debt. So these massive debt increases that we've been seeing, they've been national debt. And when you drill down even further, what you see is that they're not actually adding any underlying new debt. Effectively, most of what they're doing is paying the interest on the existing debt, which of course creates more debt to pay that interest, but then that has interest on top of it as well. So this thing sort of compounds over time. You have to issue ever larger amounts of debt, pay the interest on the debt that you've already got that you then pay additional interest on. Right, and here's the really interesting bit of all of this. If you overlay the proportion of the population in work against the government debt as a proportion of GDP, the two lines pretty much exactly match. So there is a direct correlation between the amount of people in work and the debt levels of an economy. Now, as we've been talking about, we know what's happening with that. We know what's going to be happening with these population levels, because we can see the native-born population. Like you say, just shift it forward 18 years, and there's your line. So if you have to invert the debt-GDP line, as labour rates fall and debt rises, you have fewer people in work, but these transfer programmes, they exist. So government debt rises. So if the debt crisis is mainly a function of population, and these transfer programmes make that relationship ever more solid, because of course, as people exit from the work, a lot of the time, the reason they're doing that is because they're going into old age, where they're entitled to pensions and certainly increasingly medical care, which is it is still the largest line item in the UK. It's very close to the largest line item in the US, and it is in other Western countries as well. The transfer payment to older people. Okay. So to try and tackle this unsolvable problem, they've been issuing debt, and where that isn't enough, they're just effectively adding liquidity, so printing money to come into all of this. So here's another trick that you can look at, and I'm building up to why this is also predictable. If you overlay the chart of the debt levels onto total liquidity, they also match, okay? So you know what's driving the debt, which is the population levels, the people in, available for work. And you know what's driving the liquidity, which is the debt. And you can project forward the population. And you can do this very reliably because of the births and deaths data, although the immigration is an additional factor to all of that. And furthermore, you know that there's a strong match between the interest payments on the debt issued in the previous cycle and what's then coming up to be rolled over to again today, which is very predictable because you know the issuance of the debt, you know the term that it was on. And of course, what happened last cycle? What happened last cycle was the massive money printing that happened over COVID era. And there was a massive money dump then in 2020 and 2021. And that's now coming due now. So unless this correlation, these correlations that have been matching entirely for decades now, unless that doesn't, unless that fundamentally changes in some way, you know that there is about to be a massive liquidity rise coming in the next couple of years. It's going to be significant because it has to be because of all these factors that we're talking about. We've got the trend. And they need to refinance from the last cycle, which would have been the massive amount of COVID money coming. So what it tells you is that it's going to be coming very, very soon. And it's certainly going to be strong rising in 2025 as well. In fact, 2025 should be pretty bonkers on the basis of these recurring cycles. Okay, how could this not be the case? Well, it would have to be, you know, massive cuts to spending. It would have to be, you know, an end of the spending and the transfer programs. And are they really going to do that in an election year? It's an election year in the US. It's an election year in UK. I mean, would they ever cut spending, you know, particularly in an election year? So we know that massive debasement is coming, right? And we know all of this debt is compounding. And it's only ever getting larger because all the debt issued plus the interest that rolls over again. And
to watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.